of the visit to the temple, then next week we'll talk about John the Baptist. And so our text is Luke 2, 41 through 52. Now we need to set the scene for this particular portion, because Passover was held on the 15th day of Nisan, month of Nisan. And since the Jewish calendar is a lunar rather than a solar calendar, it differs somewhat from our calendar. And this date will be in March or April of any given year. So in 2018, the Passover will be celebrated on Friday, March 30th. Immediately following the Passover would be the Festival of Unleavened Bread, which was 7 days. Now, faithful Jewish people went to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover and the Festival of Unleavened Bread. The city was simply thronged with pilgrims at that time, and the streets and roads coming and going were full of people. So if we look at Deuteronomy 16:16, it says, "Three times in a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed." So the old-timer would say, don't come with a handful of thanks and a pocket full of much obliged. Bring something. The Feast of Weeks, of course, is also known as Pentecost. And the Feast of Booths is Tabernacles. The Feast of Weeks came at the time of the wheat harvest. And the Feast of Booths was at the end of the agricultural year, as all the produce was harvested at that time. And so we begin to look at this portion, starting at verse 41. "Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And as they were returning after spending the full number of days, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but his parents were unaware of it. But supposing him to be in the caravan, and went a day's journey, they began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him. Then after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When they saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, 'Son, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you.' And he said to them, 'Why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house?' But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he continued in subjection to them, and his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men." So we see here at the time of the feast that men were commanded to come to Jerusalem for three feasts. Women were not so commanded. And so it was only the pious women, the women that desired to follow God and please God, that would undertake the toil and danger of travel to Jerusalem for the feast. We jump in a car and we drive. Okay. But people went barefoot or wore sandals and they walked. Or perhaps they rode a donkey on dusty dirt roads. Very few roads were paved. Some were paved with cobblestones around Rome. And travel was difficult and dangerous at the time. It was a 3 or 4 day journey from Nazareth. Travelers went in caravans, as is mentioned here, and they could be quite large caravans, you know, perhaps a village worth, for protection from robbers who could be found on these roads. We'll talk again another Sunday about the Good Samaritan that went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell in among robbers. But travel was difficult. And so many times the women might not have went. So this is our only actual look beyond the birth narrative of the childhood of Jesus. It's a brief glimpse. We don't see a lot. And as we go through, as we look at Luke, we can see in many places he summarized things. You know, he'll speak briefly that Jesus taught here and there, but we don't get the teaching or other things. And we know at the beginning, he said he looked into all these things and he looked at various sources and he composed this book of Luke. What I wouldn't give to see his sources that he worked from, which are lost in the sands of time. Because obviously there was both oral and written accounts of the life of Christ at the time that could be studied. And especially the historian in me would just love to get my hands on it. But Luke made his summary, and he did what he did, and obviously under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and he had reason to do it the way he did it. And so we look at his text as we have it. Now, other accounts have been written of the childhood of Jesus, but they've not been accepted by the church at all or by any authority since they were composed long after the events in question. In our account, if we look at it, seems to be a very simple lost child account. Lost and found. So the child becomes lost. Upon a search by the anxious parents, the child is found. But we want to delve beneath the surface here and see what this portion has for us. We should remember that this account contains the earliest known statements from Jesus as he answered his mother. And this is valuable in showing the state of his knowledge and the state of his awareness at an early age. I don't know if you have ever thought of this, but I have often thought of it and pondered, at what age did he become self-aware? At what age did he know who he was and what he was doing and what his mission was, what his value was? Certainly, at some age, he did know. This answers some of these questions for age 12. So we're going to look at a number of things then. Number one would be his upbringing. How was he brought up? He was raised by parents who were very careful to follow the law of Moses. We know that when they brought him to the temple for the dedication, the Lord has said elsewhere that every firstborn son would be dedicated to him. But instead of taking all the firstborn sons for his service, he took the tribe of Levi. But the parents were come for a firstborn and offer an offering at the temple in token of that. The firstborn of the animals were dedicated to the Lord. Although men were required to attend the feast in Jerusalem, Mary was not required, but she went anyway. And so we can see that she was careful to go the extra mile. She went to the feast. We read the words, after spending the full number of days. Now, the Passover was eaten, and that was like a two-day affair, the preparation and the eating of the Passover. The references I looked at said that some pilgrims came just for the Passover. Then they went. But some stayed for the full festival of unleavened bread, which was 7 days. But in verse 43, it says, they spent the full number of days. This indicates to me, instead of going to the Passover and then going home, they spent the full days for the festival of unleavened bread as well. This is added time and added expense for people that were by no means well-to-do. But it was something they desired to do. And to this day, you'll find variation in people and variation in how faithful they are in attendance, how faithful they are in giving of their resources, how faithful they are in various parts and portions of the Christian life. For those of you who are raising children, what you do and how faithful you are in that respect is something that your children are watching on a daily basis. And the things you do speak far louder than the things you might say. So through this, we get a picture of a careful religious upbringing for Jesus. And we really should not be surprised at that, because in chapter 1, we read that Mary is described as being what? Highly favored by God. And so we also see Jesus going home with Mary and Joseph and being subject to them. The child obeyed the parents, and he is waiting for the timing of the Lord as far as his later ministry. But I would contend that he understands a good deal of that later ministry at the age of 12. So, upbringing. Now, if we look at Jesus in the temple, we see that they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, right in the middle of things, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. So, Jewish teachers at that time in the first century, they would sit with their students. And now these were men who had studied the Jewish law, the Torah, and various commentaries on the law, famous rabbis, for years. They considered themselves experts in the law. And so as they taught, there would be questions and answers regarding the subject at hand as part of the teaching. Kind of a seminar type approach, if you will. And so his parents are finding him sitting with the teachers in the temple. Now, he's not teaching the teachers, but he is engaged in the question and answer part, like you might in, say, a lively college course. And so you look at an issue or you look at a problem and the question is, well, how do we solve this? What's the answer? How do we get there? Now, I say he wasn't teaching because at the age 12 in that society never would have been accepted for him to be teaching. But he could engage in the question and answer, although he was probably certainly the youngest student there talking to the teachers. Now, to this day, if you went to Israel, you would find the ultra-Orthodox there, and what the men of the ultra-Orthodox do is study. They study the Jewish law. And so, around eighth grade, they have a divide in the school, and the girls might go over to business, or they might go over to the medical field, or they might go over to any one of a number of things. They go this way. And the boys go off to, you really can't call it seminary, but it's something along those lines. It's a religious school where they study the law and the prophets. And many of them engage in that for their whole lives. That's what they do. And so here, questions and answers. And you could see a 12-year-old getting into some kind of question and answer situation with some adults. And that would not be too terribly surprising. Some 12-year-olds are quite bright. But it says, all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. Now, for a 12-year-old, that is unusual. Being wise is generally a product of age and study, or a product of age and the struggles of life. So somebody might tell you, if you're trying to do something, don't do it that way. That's not going to work. I know, because I've tried it and it didn't work for me. And so by our various mistakes that we make over the years, we learn lots and lots of things not to do. I have learned that way myself on many occasions. So, you know, we often say, well, if I could only go back to when I was 25 and know what I know now, how much better I could do in life decisions and go the right way instead of getting into some of these struggles. But in a question and answer format, everyone who heard was amazed at the wisdom of this 12-year-old boy and the questions he asked and the answers he gave. I mean, later on, when the religious leaders came up to him and demanded, by what authority do you do these things? You show us your authority. Prove to us who you are. Prove to us what you are. He said to him, okay, I'll ask you one question. And if you can answer my question, then I'll tell you. The baptism of John the Baptist, was it from men or was it from heaven? And so they went back and huddled up and they said, this is a tough one, because if we say the baptism was from heaven, then he's going to say, why didn't you believe him then? Why didn't you listen to what he said? Why didn't you repent? So we can't say that because we didn't accept John the Baptist. But if we say it was from men, all the crowd here is going to stone us with stones because they said, all believe John was a prophet. So we can't say that either. And so they came back and they said, we can't answer your question. He said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. And so we see that in the question and answer format, they were astonished both at his questions and his answers. Because sometimes you can ask a question of a person that really gets them thinking about who they are or what they're doing or what they should be doing. Now, this is only a shadow of things to come, but it's an interesting shadow. Because you'll remember, the Sanhedrin sent soldiers. They said, go get him out of the temple. We've had it with this guy. Go get him and bring him back here. And the soldier came back without him. And so the Sanhedrin said, why didn't you bring him? We told you to bring him. And they said, never a man spake like this man. And they said, well, what's the matter with you? Have you come to believe in him too? None of the leaders believe in this man. But yet the soldiers tasked with coming to arrest him, after they heard him speak, couldn't bring themselves to lay hands on him. And they said, no one ever spoke like this. What we see also in this particular section is a certain amount of tension. When the infant Jesus was presented at the temple, Simeon told Mary that the child was a sign that would be opposed, and a sword would pierce her own soul. Thus, she could expect some pain as a result of having this child. And we know that the earthly mind has great difficulty in contemplating and understanding heavenly things. In this account, we can see the beginning of a tension between his earthly family and his ministry. His relationship with his Father in heaven. And it was largely a question of priority. During his life, his ministry came first, ahead of human expectations, and in the various interactions with his family, we can see that. And so, in Mark 3, 31 through 35, it said, his mother and his brothers arrived, and standing outside, they sent word to him and called him. And a multitude was sitting around him, and they said, behold, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. And answering them, he said, who are my mother and my brothers? And looking on those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. Not exactly what the crowd expected. Because Jesus owed allegiance to his heavenly Father, and many things he did were not understood when they were weighed by earthly values. And this issue is going to continue throughout his ministry. Even those who were very close to him struggled to understand what he was doing. You remember that when he's talking about going to Jerusalem and being rejected there, Peter is saying, oh, no, 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 we can't have that. His disciples were following a Messiah to a degree of their own making. They had expectations. In those times, if you became a king, your close friends would all receive a high position. And the disciples had already been talking about sitting on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes. And so there was earthly expectations. That did not include him dying for the sins of mankind. They were looking for something far different. And that's a cautionary to us today. We must follow the Messiah as he is, as we find him in the pages of Scripture, not a construct of our own making that we would prefer, because he is what he is, nor will he change in accordance with our desires. So in this account, he is with the teachers in the temple. He's listening to them. He's asking them questions. He's answering their questions. And he'd been there for some time. And through this process, he was hearing about the state of the understanding of the law at that time. That's certainly what they were discussing, because that's what these men did. And through that, he was understanding their concept of the relationship between man and God. How did they see it? How did they understand it? In the meantime, his parents were fretting about where he was and what he was doing. And if you ever lose track of a child, that's exactly what you're going to be wondering. Where are they, and what are they up to? And what trouble are they in? His family, later on, had some issues in understanding his ministry. Not all of them believed in him. We know his brothers at one time did not believe in him, and they told him, well, why don't you go up to the feast to, you know, convince people of who you say you are? And it's helpful to understand that most of the people at the time were expecting a more political Messiah who would take the throne of David, get rid of Rome, and bring back some of the glories of the kingdom of Israel. When I talked to the rabbi up in Jamestown of Temple Hesed Abraham, he told me that they were waiting for the Messiah, and when the Messiah came, he would not be the Son of God, but he would be a man who would be able to restore the kingdom to Israel. And so it was interesting to me, anyway, that they were still looking for that, in much the same way. So there's tension there between him, his ministry, and human expectations on the part of his parents. Knowledge is our last point. Jesus had great knowledge. Many people have knowledge. We have people in this church with a considerable amount of knowledge in amazing variety of areas. We have engineers, we have musicians, we have literary folks, we have a wide expanse of knowledge. But a 12-year-old who will excite amazement is pretty rare. I mean, we can be amazed sometimes at how naughty a 12-year-old is or some of the things they do, but being amazed at their knowledge, not so much. So his knowledge, as he asked questions and answered questions, would stimulate the listeners to wonder, where did he get this? Where is this coming from? Further, his answer to his mother showed that at the age of 12, he already had knowledge of who he was. Because he says, why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house? So he had knowledge at the age of 12 that his parents did not have. Now, the translation of the exact words here is a little difficult. And some have translated, I must be about my father's business. Others translate, I must be in my father's house. Actually, the exact word is not in the most ancient manuscript. But his answer did show some of the tension between worldly things and heavenly things. For he surprised his parents didn't know where he is. So if I was going to expand his answer to his parents, I would say, why are you looking all over for me? This is my father's house here. Didn't you know this is the place I would be? He's surprised that they didn't know. So I prefer the translation, I must be in my father's house, because it works in the flow of the conversation. Because his mother is asking why he did this, and she's indicating they were looking for him, and they were anxious or they were sorrowing, they had an issue looking for him. And his reply that he had to be in his father's house indicates the temple is the first place they should have looked, so there was no need for all the searching. You know, and you wonder, I can't help but wonder, as they were walking down some dusty street, if someone didn't say, you know, there's a 12-year-old kid in the temple that is stumping the teachers with how smart he is. Most amazing thing I ever heard about. And his parents say, oh, could that be him? We better go. Because something that was amazing like that would travel pretty fast, word of mouth. The reply also shows an intimate relationship with God. So at the tender age of 12, he understood his relationship with his father. And that relationship was beyond the comprehension of his parents at that point. I don't think we should be particularly surprised at that, because if I look back to my understanding and comprehension, when I was about this age and got saved, I knew I was saved, but that's really about all I knew. I mean, how much did I know? About half a thimbleful, maybe. Understanding sometimes comes slowly. Sometimes takes years. So his parents find him in the temple, and of course, they have mixed emotions. They have emotions of relief at finding him. They got him. He's okay. Nothing bad has happened to him. Also, amazement at finding a mere child conversing with the teachers in this way, but also being a little provoked because they had to come and look for him, and he had stayed behind in the temple when they had gone on after the feast to go home. And his answer indicates they shouldn't be amazed at what he did or worried about where he was. And so if we look at verse 50, it says, but they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. They didn't get it. Now, are there things today about Christ and about the Lord and about the blessings that have been given to us and about the ministries and the things we should be doing that we don't understand? I would say definitely yes. But God is very gracious, and He gives us time, and He gives us people to come alongside us to help us to get along the road of understanding, to understand more. Paul says someday he would understand fully, just as he has been fully understood. And so they didn't understand, though they raised him and were close to him in some respects. They didn't really know him in that way. The lack of understanding, then, is the key to the tension between earthly relationships, his relationship to his Father, and the ministry which he was sent to do, which was directed by God. And so the Jewish tradition and the Jewish history understood clearly a prophet bringing a word from God. But there was really nothing to prepare the people for the Son of God coming and showing teaching and power direct from God. Continual teaching, miracles, signs, healing, walking on the water, stilling the storm. His disciples said, "What manner of man is this that we've got hooked up with here? Who is he? What is he?" Because they were human in their understanding, as are we. They were human in their expectations, as are we. So it makes clear to me anyway that at age 12, Jesus had a deep understanding far beyond what we would expect from a child, much more. And this is an issue that was going to follow him throughout his earthly ministry. He had to try and make people understand the things that he knew and they did not. Any of you who have ever been teachers certainly know that it's one thing to thoroughly understand a subject, and it's quite another to explain it successfully to a student so they also understand. As you're talking, do their eyes glaze over? Are they fidgeting with their pencil? Are they peeking at their phone? Chances are good that what you're saying is not finding lodging in their brain. So sometimes his efforts were greeted by ignorance, as people simply didn't understand what he was saying. They didn't get it. Any teacher can tell you about occasions like that. Sometimes when people, and particularly people in authority, the religious experts, when they did understand what he was saying, what he said was greeted by extreme hostility. So you have the ignorance on the one hand, but then sometimes the people that got it were very hostile because they didn't want to hear what he had to say when they understood it. We see at the end of the passage that Jesus went back to Nazareth and was subject to his parents, because although he knew things his parents did not know, and this gap was going to continue to increase, he also knew it was acceptable to God that he be in obedience to his parents until such time as he was ready to leave that home. But as for Mary, she kept all these things in her heart. She treasured them. She thought about them. She pondered about them, trying to understand. Now, it's possible, although Luke doesn't name his sources, that she is one of Luke's sources for this account. because there's some very personal details in there that you would assume would have to come from a family member, a father, a mother, a brother, or a close relation of some kind. But in this little brief glimpse of his childhood, we can find some very interesting things to remember. He knew who he was. He knew that he would need to be in his father's house. The account of Luke starts with him being presented at the temple. Now we get him back in the temple again. And as we go through the Gospels, we're going to find him in the temple time and time again, teaching and trying to explain people the gospel and what he wanted them to know. That's what we do now. Okay? We try to lay out the gospel. We try to explain the person of Jesus, who he was, what he did, how to come to him. After you come to him, what he desires, what he wishes you to do. That's what the church is all about. We preach the gospel in season or out of season. Exhort, rebuke, all of those things. And so we're going to try then to continue on through Luke, at least for a while, and try to mine out all the blessings that we possibly can. But we'll have our closing hymn now.